You're listening to Expanding Horizons, the podcast of the Unitarian Church of South Australia, a home of progressive spirituality and free religious thought and action since 1854. The views expressed in these podcasts are those of the speaker and are not intended to represent the position of the church itself or of the worldwide Unitarian Universalist movement. For more information, visit unitariansa.org.au.
Is called Becoming Nadembo. My name is Ardi. I live in a large village. It is surrounded by jungle. We make our homes from mud with a kind of straw on top. Only the people from my tribe live in the village. I've never seen anyone from another tribe. I'm a young man. I'm good at hunting. I've also helped build a few houses. Soon my parents will find a woman for me to live with. But first, I wanted to become Nadembo. All of the best people in my village are Nadembo. I cannot describe it. They are just the best people. They get to decide everything. Men and women can be Nadembo. If there is a meeting to decide anything, it always goes the way the Nadembo want it to be. Whether it is talking about the way to build a hut, or solving a dispute, or how to build an irrigation ditch for the crops outside the village. I kept asking my parents when I can become Nadembo. I kept saying, I'm good at hunting. I'm one of the strongest and fastest young men in the village. I could even build a hut by myself. When can I become Nadembo? My father would say to me each time, you are good at hunting. You are one of the strongest and fastest young men. You could probably build a hut by yourself. But to become Nadembo, you must be patient. One day when I was alone in our home, the doctor came to the doorway, and he called me. He asked me to walk with him. I went out and walked by his side as he led me towards the jungle. We walked in a little way. He said, if you were burning with desire to become Nadembo, now is your time. Are you ready for anything? I said, of course, I want to become Nadembo more than anything. He promised not to tell anyone what I needed to do. It is wrong for me to be telling you this story, but you are far away people, and I know you'll never come to my village. I did exactly what he asked me to, which I will describe. The next day, there was a big ceremony in the center of the village. The doctor stood next to me and yelled out, this man wants to become Nadembo. Who says he should not become Nadembo? The crowd was gathered around, but no one said anything. One could only hear the screeches of the birds in the distance. The doctor wrapped large leaves around my eyes so I could not see. He whispered to me, open your mouth. He threw some seeds of herbs into my mouth and whispered, chew and swallow. I felt my face twisting up at the bitterness of what I was doing. It was so bitter it made my mouth go all prickly, but I didn't spit it out, I swallowed it. Almost immediately I felt extremely ill and weak and powerless. My legs couldn't hold me up and I fell to the ground. I was convulsing, but I didn't vomit. Then it hurt so much to move that I did my best to remain still. Some men picked up my body, which was now stiff, and put me onto a mat, which I knew was attached to two long sticks, because they picked me up and carried me on the mat right out of the village. They carried me a long way. I still couldn't see. I felt I could not move my body, and after a long time they put me down and rolled me onto the ground. I heard the doctor's voice. He said, you must stay here for a very long time. There is a place in the tree where you can live. There is a rock near the bushes where people will come and leave food sometimes, but you are not to leave this place. They left me. Gradually, with a lot of effort, I managed to start moving my arms and legs. As soon as I could, my hands reached up to my head and I took off the leaves, which had been wrapped around my forehead. I was, indeed, in the middle of the jungle, but I could see in the tree above me there was a small hut between the branches. That is where I lived for over a year. As the doctor said, sometimes food was left for me. I was able to catch some small animals as well. That's a long story. And with sticks and two stones, I was able to make a fire to cook them. Other than that, I lived in the hut. I heard the doctor's voice one day. "Come down," he said. I climbed down the tree and followed him back to the village. A crowd was there to meet me. They were happy to see me, and they all reached out to touch me. Following the doctor's instructions, I acted as if I'd never seen a village before and never even seen people before. I was like a man who had just been created, transported from the spirit world. So I did not speak, but they led me to the main hut where there was plenty of food on the table. Other Ndembo people joined in the feast. I was so happy I could not stop smiling. And that is how I became Ndembo.
Now we come to another traditional part of our service where we can express a joy or a concern to the rest of the group and light a candle. I'll light one final candle for those joys and concerns we have in our hearts but are not up to expressing right at the moment.
By no people does the custom of sacrificing the human representative of a god appear to have been observed so commonly and with so much solemnity as by the Aztecs of ancient Mexico. With the ritual of these remarkable sacrifices we are all well acquainted, for it has been fully described by the Spaniards who conquered Mexico in the 16th century and whose curiosity was naturally excited by the discovery in this distant region of a religion which presented many curious points of analogy to the doctrine and ritual of their own church. They took a captive, and before they sacrificed him to their gods, they gave him the name of the god to whom he should be sacrificed, and dressed him with the same ornaments as worn by their god, saying that he represented the god, and during the time that this representation lasted, which was for a year in some feasts, in others 6 months, and in others less, they revered and worshipped him in the same manner as the proper god. And in the meantime he ate, drank, and was merry. When he went through the streets, the people came forth to worship him, and everyone brought him a gift, along with children and sick people, that he might cure them and bless them. And sometimes he played a small flute, so the people might prepare to worship him. The feast being come, and he grown fat, they killed him, opened him, and ate him, making a solemn sacrifice of him.
So you'll notice a theme in the story today, and in the reading that Iran just gave, a theme of resurrection, of rising again. Now, maybe I shouldn't have given the name to the topic risen, because that does have all sorts of connotations, but if I had called it Stories of the Resurrected, you might have thought it was going to be a zombie flick or something like that. I might have got a better audience, actually. But look, it's Easter Sunday, so let me start by acknowledging the traditional Easter greeting of Christians as a starting point. I'm unable to trace when this formula originated, but it is very old, not in the first century of the Common Era, but perhaps within a few centuries afterwards. It is common on Easter Sunday in the Roman Catholic Church, in the Eastern Orthodox churches, and many of the Protestant churches for one person to greet another, "Christ is risen," to which the formula answer is, "He is risen indeed." And of course, it's a foundational belief for Christians that Yeshua was crucified to the point of death and was then revived in his physical body. Let us respect those who hold those beliefs. The question I address today, though, is what about all the other resurrected gods? Why are there so many stories about gods and others experiencing death and then experiencing life once more? What can it mean for us as each one of us individually faces the end of this physical life? So let's meet some of the resurrected today, and this is really only a sample. I'll tell you the stories of Tammuz and Ishtar, Persephone and Demeter, Osiris, Isis and Horus, Quetzalcoatl, Odin, and then I'll come back to Yeshua. So if we go to Mesopotamia, many of these stories of gods dying and then rising again in some form are linked to the seasons. The myths explained the seasons and gave reassurance that spring would come again. Mesopotamia was one of the first places where there was large-scale settled farming. There was no need to travel nomadically when it was so easy to grow crops with so much water. Incidentally, the name Mesopotamia is from the Greek for between the rivers, referring to the Euphrates and the Tigris. It was part of the so-called Fertile Crescent, stretching in an arc from the Nile to the Persian Gulf. So the love story of Ishtar and Tammuz was told by a poet 4,300 years ago, and undoubtedly the story goes back longer than that. There are several versions, but it goes something like this. Ishtar was the mother goddess. Her consort was Tammuz. Her sister was queen of the underworld. Ishtar travelled to the underworld, and her sister suspected, probably correctly, that Ishtar was setting out to take over the jurisdiction. So the queen of the underworld kills Ishtar. Ishtar then belongs in the underworld, clearly. Fortunately, the god of wisdom finds a way to revive Ishtar and return her to the upper world. A pack of demons accompany her, but now there's a problem. Because by immutable law, there is a vacancy in the underworld which must be filled. So one by one, Ishtar and the demons come across the women who were in service to Ishtar before she descended. And each one of them are so overjoyed to see her again, so relieved. Their devotion, their love is evident. So on each occasion, the demons say, "Shall I grab this one?" And Ishtar says, "No, no, no. Not this one." And then finally she gets back to Tammuz, who is sitting on a throne, quite relaxed, taking it easy, chilling out with a few slave girls, and Ishtar is not impressed. So it be like this. Tammuz is in front of the TV, Ishtar comes back from the underworld, and he says, "Hang on, the Port's playing Melbourne. They're 83 all, and it's 4 minutes to go. Look, I'll be with you in about 4 minutes, okay?" And Ishtar says, "No, take him." And the demons grab him and take him down to the underworld. Typical bloke. Sadly, Port lost, but anyway. It was a true story from last night. So, when I said the demons took him down to the underworld, I don't mean the Melbourne football team. I mean the actual demons in the story. Yeah. So, anyway, Ishtar, loving wife, has a change of heart, so she descends again to the underworld. A deal is done to allow Tammuz to resurface at the beginning of spring each year. And since his job was vegetation and crops, they can do well and flourish. Until at the end of summer, the time comes again when he must return to the underworld, and the cycle continues. The Greek version is slightly less convoluted. Persephone, or Persephone, you would say, is the daughter of Demeter, the harvest goddess. That's important. The problem was that Hades, king of the underworld, took a liking to her. Not to put too fine a point on it, he abducted and raped her. That's what happens to us all in this world. Anyway, looking on the bright side, she became queen of the underworld. So Demeter searches everywhere for her daughter but cannot find her. When she finds out Persephone's fate, she's as heartbroken as a god can be. Hades is not really the sort of bloke you want as a son-in-law. Demeter, the harvest goddess, withdraws into seclusion, leaving the world in drought and ruin. And this prompts the other gods to take some action. So Hermes, the messenger of the gods, is sent to bring Persephone back. In the end, there's a compromise, allowing Persephone to return for 6 months of the year, spring and summer, and then she returns to her home in the underworld. Note that Persephone continues to retain her personality and power in the underworld. Being dead for these people just means going to another place. Nevertheless, it's a typical story of a dying and rising god returning to allow the return of spring. And the Romans, as with so much of their mythology, echoed the Greek stories. And on a Roman brooch, there is told the story of Diana and Proserpina, who are the equivalent of Demeter and Persephone. The older Egyptian story of Osiris and Isis is another story of resurrection. Osiris, apart from being a god, became the pharaoh or king of Egypt, and his wife was Isis. His older brother Set came up with a plan to usurp the throne. Set secretly measured the dimensions of the body of Osiris. He had a chest made up which would exactly fit the dimensions of his brother. One night at a party after Osiris had returned from travels, Set offered the beautiful chest to any of the revelers who would fit snugly within it. Many tried, but only one could fit perfectly, Osiris. Immediately, Set had his thugs shut the lid. They threw the chest into the Nile. Osiris could not survive. According to one version, thanks Plutarch, the chest was washed up on the shores of Syria, where a sacred tree sprung up very quickly. The king ordered the tree to be cut down so that a beautiful pillar of wood could be installed as part of his palace, and the chest was still inside the tree. Eventually, Isis tracked down the location of the chest and managed to negotiate the removal of the chest back to Egypt. And believe me, that is a long story cut short. But Set was on to them. He managed to seize the body of Osiris and cut it into 14 pieces, which were then scattered in the Nile River. But Isis was able to recover the body parts, well, most of them, and revive Osiris sufficiently to make love to the reconstituted body. She wasn't called the fertility goddess for nothing. So the result was the birth of her son Horus, who later manages to vanquish Set, send his parents off to be with the gods, and succeed his father to the throne. It's interesting the similarities between some of these myths of jealous brothers and all the rest of it. And meanwhile, in Central America, one of the greatest of gods of the Mayan, Toltec, and Aztec people was Quetzalcoatl, usually depicted as a feathered serpent. There are so many depictions from the Egyptian times with the same sort of modelling that we see in the Christian faith. Interesting to see how it's developed. Like Osiris, Quetzalcoatl was associated with agriculture and vegetation, and also had a brother who wanted to bring him down. Quetzalcoatl was tricked into such bad behaviour, basically sleeping with the priestesses, that he burnt himself to death in shame, but he was able to rise again out of the ashes. Now, there are more stories of resurrection in Hindu stories, even Jewish literature as well. But let me give one more example before returning to more familiar territory. Odin was the chief god of the Norse people, more or less the people of Scandinavia as we know it now. He had two ravens representing thought and memory, which could travel over the world to bring him back. The thoughts and memories and knowledge of other people. Being a wise person, he wanted to become even wiser. He put out one of his own eyes in order to have clearer sight. More than that, in supreme self-sacrifice, he stuck a spear in his own side and hung himself on a tree for 9 days. And he emerged with greater wisdom and power than ever. Now, tell me if you've heard the story before. I quote from the Havamal, a section of the Elder Edda, the mythological poetry of the Norse people. The Havamal speaks here in Odin's voice. I know that I hung on that windy tree 9 full nights, a spear wound given to Odin, myself to myself. On that tree that rose from roots that no one ever knows. They gave me neither bread nor drink from the horn. I peered down below. I clutched the runes. Screaming, I grabbed them and then sank back. Then I quickened and flourished, sprouted and thrived. From a single word, another sprung. From a single deed, another sprung. Coming back to the case of Yeshua, it's not easy for us in these times to appreciate the sense of permeability of the veil of death in the Mediterranean world 2,000 years ago. Ghosts and spirits were a fact of life. For most Greeks and Romans, at least, the dead had not vanished. Their souls had simply transferred to another realm. Compared to our ears, it was probably less shocking to the Greeks and Romans of the time that there was talk of a Messiah figure who had revived after a couple of nights in the tomb. Even so, let us consider the words of Susan Isles Johnston in her book Restless Dead, Encounters Between the Living and the Dead in Ancient Greece. Quote, "The person who once ate and drank and laughed with the rest of us is gone. And yet she continues to inhabit the world of those who knew her. Because the dead remain part of our mental and emotional lives long after they cease to dwell beside us physically, it is easy to assume that they are simply carrying on their existence elsewhere and might occasionally come back to visit us. From this assumption arise a variety of hopes and fears." The question is, why have humans in many cultures around the world woven stories of gods and perhaps even people dying and being reborn? Is it a matter of simply giving us hope? There is nothing the ego resists more than the thought of extinction. In ancient times, it was understandable that people would crave reassurance that spring would return next year and that the crops would again flourish. It was a matter of group survival. Obviously, here and now, people continue to have beliefs which conceive of life transcending death in some way or another, perhaps with an afterlife for the soul, perhaps with reincarnation. I'm not saying they're wrong. Rather than dwelling on those matters today, I want to suggest to you a different sort of revival. Imagining yourself to be nothing but a generous, kind, and sensible person. That can be you. That is you. Just as the Easter story represents a radical transformation, that is possible for you now. You can literally walk out of here a changed person. And I'm not talking about anything supernatural. I'm just talking about letting go of the fears and anxieties and inhibitions that hold us back from being as loving as we can be. You can be at peace. You can be a beacon of joy and kindness for others. So take the opportunity of this Easter Sunday to reinvent yourself. You once loved without doubt or hesitation. Let go of the hurt of the world and revive that part of you. I finish with the words of J.R.R. Tolkien in his book, The Fellowship of the River. Quote, "All that is gold does not glitter. Not all those who wander are lost. The old that is strong does not wither. Deep roots are not reached by the frost. From the ashes a fire shall be woken. A light from the shadows shall spring. Renewed shall be the blade that was broken. The crownless again shall be king." We hope you've enjoyed this Expanding Horizons podcast. These podcasts are the intellectual property of the presenter. They can be used only with the express permission and appropriate acknowledgement of the presenter. This permission can be obtained by emailing admin@unitarianSA.org.au. Please feel free to leave a comment or visit us on Facebook or Twitter by searching SA Unitarians or by visiting our website at unitarianSA.org.au.